Our tools and implements shall be designed with a view to make life not only possible in this, but make life augment. Life shall prosper. How to go about this? We shall have to explore, find out. And I hope the intelligence of our young men in this country has not reached its limit. We have been fond of copying. Copying has been the vogue in this country. I don't make any distinction between East and West. The earth is round. And all East and West are myths, geographical fictions. But I don't believe in revolution being copied. It was Stalin who said, revolution cannot be exported. Every country in its particular context has to explore its own technique of revolution. Now what's the context in this country? Ours is a country which is not highly industrialized. Our first problem is hunger. And the answer to hunger is food and not factory manufactured goods. So we have to begin with the land. The earth has been called in Sanskrit by various names, but there is one name which is very important, Vasundhara, Vasumati. Vasu means wealth. There is wealth in the bowels of the earth. And this we have to search, not to exploit, but to use to make our life gratifying, blessed. So we have got to look to the earth as the first means of making this revolution possible. As I asked yesterday, a very pertinent question, to whom should this earth belong? And I suggested, though I didn't say it in so many words, that it should belong to the tiller. And what does belonging mean? Belonging does not mean absolute ownership. The right to use. There is this difference between private property and personal property. Personal property is that which I use actually. So it will be a sort of personal property, not absolute property, at his absolute disposal, with the right to alienate, to sell it. Because as I told you, we want to establish relationship between men and relationship between men and everything else. So relationship precludes alienation of any kind. We want relationship, kinship, not alienation. Alienation is separates. Alienation is divisive. Relationship joins. It is cohesive. So this, he will not be entitled to alienate. It will not be his property. It was perhaps one of those utopian socialists who were intellectual giants who said, all property is improperty, impropriety. So there shall be no property in the sense that we can do with it as whatever we like. We hold it to use it for the benefit of the individual and for the benefit of society as a whole. That is what Vinoba meant when he said, the land shall belong to all, to God. There shall be no collective ownership either. It shall never be the absolute ownership of the village even. State ownership is state capitalism. Collective ownership is collective capitalism. But social ownership, loka swamitva, is quite different. It's a different concept altogether. It belongs to no one in particular. It belongs to all, and therefore it belongs to God. Unless we chalk out some program connected with production of food, we shall not be able to make any headway whatsoever. So this is essentially necessary. Villagization of the land, you may call it, for a better phrase, for a want of a better phrase. All land shall belong to the village, that is to the people, to no one in particular. Let us not forget that Vinoba made an experiment which perhaps was the most courageous and most glorious made by any man in history. And he deserves well of his people. He said the land shall belong to no one. And he wanted to bring about a revolution through cooperation, a revolution through persuasion. He did not fail. He partially succeeded. But even if he had failed, his failure would have been more glorious than our sordid successes. So he has blazed a trail which he may have left, but it's for us to follow it up in our own way. We need not be followers either of Gandhi, Marx or Vinoba. A follower never makes a forward step, never takes a forward step. Kaka Sahib Karl Elker once read out to us a sentence from the life of Jesus Christ. And the sentence read, "Not knowing how to punish great men for their greatness, fate punishes them with disciples." So the followers, the successors are not disciples. Gandhi was a successor of Gokhale and Tilak, not a follower, not a disciple. That therefore he could not be contained either in Gokhale's camp or in Tilak's camp. So is Vinoba, Gandhi's successor, not his disciple or follower. And so is Jayaprakash, the successor of both, the follower of neither. It's the successor's proud privilege to take one step forward, which the disciple and the follower have neither the courage nor the inclination to do. They never take that step forward. Now, as I said, we have had two revolutions in this century. And we have to learn from these revolutions, not to copy them, but to learn from these revolutions and take one step forward. What have we to learn? Marx predicted that a revolution will take place only in those countries which are highly industrialized, because only in those countries could the contradiction inherent in capitalism come to a head. But as fate would have it, the revolution started not in those countries which were highly industrialized, where there we had a proletariat. What's a proletarian? A proletarian is one who works but does not own. One who labors but does not own. But there were no proletarians in Russia, much less in China. For the first time in the history of socialism, was the peasant allowed to join a socialist revolution. In Orthodox communism, a peasant could never become a member of the Communist Party. Marx in his Capital has labeled him as the last citadel of capitalism, the petit bourgeois. Because he owns his land and he works on a piece of land, the produce of which he enjoys, which is not the case in a factory. So what's the industrial context? Perhaps this is the last point which I would like to make this evening. What's the industrial context? Because that will help us to determine what an agrarian revolution, a farmer's revolution, would be like. In an industrial context, in a factory, there are three characteristic features. The first is that there are a handful of masters and thousands of workers. That's the first thing. The second thing is that those who work do not do their own work. They work for others. And you know, when a man works for others, he shirks work. He stops work. Because it doesn't do any harm to him. The loss is of the employer. Suppose I am a professor in a college and I join a pen strike. I come home and teach my grandson. The grandson asks me, "You are on strike. Why do you teach me?" "I teach you because this is my own work. I can strike where I do not do my own work." So strike is a weapon that is effective when you do another man's work. Then there is a third characteristic. All laborers work in the same campus, in the same compound. So, organization is easy. They can be easily organized. And they can overwhelm the masters, the employers, because they are few in number. They can stop work. That is why the Marxist revolution was conceived in an industrial context. But Lenin had to develop, invent a separate, an original technique, and Mao, much original. He has written, Mao, in his work, "If 10 marks be allotted to the whole revolution, 7 points should go to the farmer, to the peasant." And what peasants? Had they any knowledge of this revolution? Did they know about it? When after the long march and after Mao's victory, his soldiers marched into Peking, they ran towards these electric bulbs to light their cigarettes. They were so ignorant. But unlettered, not men of letters, but men of sense. They knew what they wanted. They had that consciousness. So in an agrarian revolution, friends, there are three things which are just opposite to the context in an industrial complex. The first is that in an agricultural context, the small owner is in great numbers. The non-owner, that is the landless laborer, is less numerous comparatively than the small owner. Now this small owner is the backbone of all land ownership, or all peasant proprietorship. I'll tell you an instance from my own life. I once was traveling in a first-class compartment. The members of my family came to see me off. As the train was about to start, my daughter asked me whether I knew that I had 500 rupees in my pocket. I didn't know, so I was quite unconcerned. But as soon as she said, I had 500 rupees in my pocket, the anxiety started. The worry started. Putra adapi dhanabhajam bhiti. What will become of these 500 rupees if I am alone in this compartment? So my daughter suggested, why not take a companion? How is it possible at the nick of that moment? Then she suggested, a young man who had come with him might accompany me. I was glad and I invited him. He entered my compartment. They bought a ticket for him. I asked him, have you any money on you? He said, I had come to see you off. How could I have any money? I have left my purse at home. So I gave him 25 rupees. And after 10 minutes told him that there were great robberies on this line. So you had better be careful. So he kept vigil the whole night for the sake of those 10 rupees. And I was snoring with my 490. That is how the small owner becomes the guardian of great ownership, of big ownership. He is the sentinel of his own ownership and also the watchman of the big owner. So it's the small owner whose sympathies for this revolution have to be enlisted. There are three traditional methods of eliminating proprietorship and property. The first is expropriation. The second is confiscation. The third is taxation. But in this country, the small owner has the largest number of votes. And he is in such large numbers that you cannot expropriate him without a civil war. So expropriation is out of the question. If you doubt my statement, you may ask Shankaran Namudripad and Jyoti Bose. Then there is confiscation. The state cannot attach it because he has the largest number of votes. He shall hold the government out of office. Taxation also is not possible for the same reason. It will not be passed by parliament. Then what remains? Voluntary abdication. Daan, which Vinoba tried. And if you will have it, failed. Failed with a very in a noble way. Revolution, Mao said, is not a work of art. It's not a dinner party. It's not painting a portrait or writing a poem. But I want to tell you, in all seriousness, that we want to develop revolution into a fine art. Then alone can cultural advance come in the wake of an economic revolution. Vinoba tried this, and after trying for some time, gave it up. Revolution is much like a relay race. One horse takes you to a certain stage and then you change horses. But this is not changing governments. Changing governments is different from changing horses in a revolution. You have so many strikes, so many ghiraus, and so many riots in universities and what not. We seem to be heading headlong towards anarchy. This may result in a change of government. Congress has gone, the Janata Party has come. The Janata Party may find it impossible to carry on. And who will come back? The Congress. This country seems to be like this stupid farmer who has only two pairs of bullocks which have had their day. And he keeps changing them to no purpose. This is very cheap politics, pettifogging. This is not people's politics. This is not mature politics. Mature politics is changing revolutionary horses in a relay race. So we have to advance because there is no other way of expropriating the small owner. So if the landless labor and small owner join hands, the big owner shall be isolated. And the big owner will have left no strength to resist. This is the technique of revolution, which we will have to follow broadly if we want to bring about a humanistic, a cultural, as well as an economic revolution, which will be one step further than the revolution in China. Friends, I have kept you sufficiently long, and I am afraid I have tried your patience. But I shall conclude this with a word of hope. The wiseacres and the worldly wise men, the practicalists, will never join you. For them, discretion is the better part of valor. They are more prudent than wise. You will have to rally some fools who do not have much of worldly wisdom. I am reminded of the anecdote of a professor who found himself at a deadlock. He had an experiment before him. If he proceeded with the experiment, there was risk to his life. If he stopped the experiment, the advance of science will be stopped. So he was in a dilemma. He asked his colleague, "What should I do?" He said, "Consult the senior." But because the senior is not only well-versed in his subject, but also more cunning than the junior. So he went to the senior, "What should I do?" And the senior gave him a very wonderful prescription. If you want a difficult job done, get the damn fool to do it who does not know that it cannot be done. We need such damned fools. Gandhi was our damned fool of the first water. He did not know that independence could not be won without arms. So he rushed where angels fear to tread. And the second fool was Vinoba Bhave, who is still regarded as perhaps the prince of fools in this country. And then Jai Prakash Narayan succeeded with his more glorious failure. Shall we hope and pray that the race of such fools in this country shall increase? May their tribe increase is my prayer. And with that prayer, I thank you all. Namaskar.